This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 82nd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have here with me today, Kevin Fu. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Gary.
Kevin Fu is an associate professor in the EECS department at the University of Michigan. He is a principal investigator in the SPQR Security and Privacy Research Group there. His research focuses on embedded computer systems and encompasses safety, security, and performance. Kevin just moved from the University of Massachusetts, for those of you wondering. Professor Fu served as a visiting scientist at the FDA, Harvard Medical School, Microsoft Research, and MIT. His PhD is in EECS from MIT. He also holds a Certificate of Achievement in Artisanal Bread Making from the French Culinary Institute, which has got to be the coolest credential ever. So thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
First off, we have to put on our investigative journalism hat. So you ready for this? It seems a striking coincidence that MIT-like hacks have shown up in Ann Arbor lately. Did you or did you not have anything to do with the Bob and Betty Beister bubbler?
I can neither confirm nor deny, but it was before my time here. Gary, you're referring to the working hot tub that appeared on the roof of our computer science and engineering building, now named the Bob and Betty Beister building.
So it was the Bob and Betty Beister bubbler on the Bob and Betty Beister building.
That is correct. I hear the students enjoyed it swimmingly.
And this was before your time, you claim.
I will stick to that claim.
Okay, then. Apparently, I got to take my investigative journalism hat back off. You have a growing cadre of grad students working for you. Back when I went to grad school, I picked my advisor first and then figured out where he was. That was exactly when Doug Hofstetter moved from Michigan to Indiana, by the way. He was my advisor. Presumably, you think that's a good piece of advice for picking a grad school or an advisor. What recommendations do you have other than that for people thinking about grad school?
Well, that's a good question. I agree the number one thing is finding the advisor that fits what you want to do. I think it's also important to look at what kind of opportunities are available for collaboration. So for instance, not to pick on any school, but Michigan, right? They have, it's an engineering campus here, but they also have a fantastic medical school. So that positions the university well for a student who wants to do interdisciplinary research mm-hmm. that crosses computer security and medicine.
So you sort of take a look at what's available instead of just randomly applying to schools, kind of like what my son Jack is doing for college now. He's randomly applying, it seems to me.
Well, I think undergraduate and graduate are different stories, but I'm not sure to what you're referring. But certainly be strategic in where you're applying to graduate school. There's no need to apply to a top graduate school if there's no one there working on the topic you enjoy. I would recommend taking the list of potential advisors as a high priority.
Mm-hmm. Any other super high priority items in the choice there?
Oh, well, you have to have good food nearby and good social.
Espresso.
We do have a secret espresso club.
Uh-huh. It's not so secret. It's on the inner tubes.
Oh, shoot.
So you've done lots of work with embedded devices, including RFID and low-energy sensors and all sorts of other cool stuff. What's the coolest gizmo you've ever built?
Huh. Well, the coolest gizmo. Well, how about the gizmo I had the most fun creating, I don't know if it's the coolest, was probably 10 or 15 years ago when we made a cryptographic telephone. This was around the time where the U.S. government was debating the Clipper chip and Skipjack, so it was quite a lot of fun to do something that was still socially relevant and technically challenging too. Trying to do it on an 8051 microcontroller with a Diffie-Hellman key exchange is no walk in the park.
I love it. Did you get it to work?
We kind of got it to work, but we were computer scientists. We had our Butterworth filters and a few analog components, but we failed to get the hybrid to work. That is the part of a telephone that essentially combines the transmit and the receive, and we failed to get that to work. Also, we failed because I accidentally soldered off the legs of a Qualcomm vocoder.
Live and learn. Soldering irons are not to be wielded lightly.
Yeah, don't ever ask a computer scientist to do surface mount soldering. That's my recommendation.
Well, good thing you're in EECS now. Maybe they'll teach you something.
So, right. It's all simulation now anyway.
So what's the coolest gizmo you've ever seen that you didn't build?
Well, I have to say the implantable medical devices are the most amazing devices I've ever seen, just because of the kind of care they can deliver in such a small space. And the complexity they have to tame in order to work at all. It's just amazing to me that these devices exist.
Mm-hmm. They are pretty amazing. I wanted to talk about that next anyway. The security ramifications of embedded devices are always interesting and sometimes even surprising. You're currently teaching the first course in the world on embedded medical device security. Do tell.
Well, right. So this is a course on medical device security. But it's actually a little bit broader than that. So this was motivated over the last 5 or 6 years. I've seen just one-offs, just various problems involving security and medical devices, and very few solutions have been proposed. And I decided there have been too many just complaints about problems. It's time to start finding solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So in this course, we introduce the students to the concepts and the philosophies to consider to make medical devices more trustworthy.
So obviously, you know, since about half, in 2006, about half the embedded medical devices had software in them, software security obviously plays a big role. And as you know, that's a topic near and dear to my own heart.
That's right. Software is becoming more and more prevalent. There was a real sea change in the late 80s and early 90s with the introduction of software replacing many hardware functions in medical devices. Today, you'd be hard-pressed to go into a hospital and not find some kind of software-controlled medical device.
Mm-hmm. It's just ubiquitous now.
It's ubiquitous, and wireless is everywhere. Wireless is everywhere.
Right, so now you can hack somebody's heart from across the room with one of those Pringles can antennas.
I don't know about that technical statement, but...
All right.
Maybe let me comment though. Medical devices, even if a medical device is vulnerable to some kind of security problem, that doesn't mean it's the sky is falling.
Right.
Patients are much better off with these devices than without.
Mm-hmm.
Even with the security problems they're in.
Oh, that's a good point. So I think that the press tends to hyperbolize and exaggerate just to make things sensational. And I wanted to ask you what your opinion of the press coverage in the area, for example, the recent Washington Post story that Avi was in. You know, what do you think about that?
Well, I think the article you're referring to had more to do with malware and clinical environments. Is that correct?
I think some, but I mean, it was about medical devices in general, and I think malware was part of it. They sort of mush it all up together in a crazy way, which is what the popular press often does.
Right. Reporters are people too. They're humans, and sometimes they make mistakes of interpretation. Things can be taken out of context. I think the take-home message is that cracks are showing with respect to computer security as these devices are becoming more interconnected and depend upon more for clinical decision-making. But the sky is not falling yet.
Right. So if you think about the trinity of trouble that I talked about a trillion years ago, you know, being internetworked, being complicated, and then having extensibility built right in, we see that happening now in medical devices in spades.
Right, but maybe you'd add a fourth category. I don't know what your trinity would become, quaternary or something.
It can still be a trinity according to Douglas Adams.
Oh, really? Oh, that's terrific.
Remember,
okay.
He wrote the fourth book in the trilogy, so...
Well, I think there's also the the economic side. There's quite a bit of interest in security economics, and in the medical device security world, I think in some way it epitomizes sort of the economic reasons for not improving medical device security. There are many disincentives for doing so.
Mm-hmm. What? The regulatory disincentives?
Well, I'd say the regulatory world is neither an incentive or disincentive. It causes it to be different, shall we say. Some of the more clear disincentives are the risks a clinical facility may take in voluntarily reporting a problem.
Oh, I see. So if you become a whistleblower, all of a sudden nobody wants you to be on the cutting edge, and they'll think that you're just out to out them or gain publicity or something.
Well, so here's the thing. I mean, if I have yet to find a single hospital that has been malware-free,
mm-hmm.
But no hospital wants to talk about having even a single piece of malware. They don't want to admit to it publicly. But in private, I get all these phone calls saying, "Oh, I have malware on these medical devices. Well, you know, what should I do about it?
Right.
Please don't tell anyone who I am."
The patient has a virus. Oh, right. Which kind?
Right. So there's a bit of the bad news diode going on. They love to report good news, but the bad news doesn't really flow up the chain.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I think there's quite a bit of confusion between interpretations of, shall we say, FDA guidance on computer security.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes manufacturers will claim that FDA rules prevent software updates, for instance.
Yeah, I love your software security patches posters that you made for hospital CIOs. I guess you've done two of those now. Are they actually having an impact? They're really cool.
Well, I hope so. I've yet to see any above any urinals in hospitals, but I'm hoping someday I'll find one in a bathroom stall in the right place. But to summarize, there are many manufacturers who are still deploying Windows XP boxes with Surface Pack 0, shall we say. This is no patches at all since, what was that, 2002?
Wow.
So naturally, these medical devices will get infected, within moments of connecting it to a network, even with firewalls, even with other kinds of physical protections.
Mm-hmm.
And an often claimed reason that I believe is mostly false is that FDA rules prevent software updates. In fact, FDA guidance does the opposite. It says that manufacturers should keep their operating systems up to date and patched.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why I think there's some confusion is that, as you know, security validation, testing, and so on and so forth is not free. And if you change medical device software, there is a non-trivial cost to verifying, validating, et cetera, these patches.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, if you've got a medical device on the market, you're responsible for keeping it safe and effective. So it seems that somebody forgot to plan ahead for these costs.
Right, right. That is very interesting. It's important that things be updated, but what about, where we are now in the laptop and phone world where you get an update every 4 seconds? Would that be good on a medical device? Instant update.
Well, you see, the interesting thing which really drew me into the medical device world is how it's not only about risks. There are very clear benefits to a device, even a device that has risks. Because don't forget, the patients receiving a device are already predisposed to some kind of other risk, such as a chronic disease.
Yeah, diabetes or maybe heart disease or something like that for the most common devices, I assume.
Right, for example. So it's reasonable to accept some risk, and the hard part is deciding what's the appropriate amount of risk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. I did some medical device work a long time ago when I wrote this book called Software Fault Injection, which is by far the worst selling book I've ever written. Since then, devices have gotten way more complex, although some are still, as you say, based on ancient versions of Windows. How do we handle complexity growth and, you know, the convergence that we see on our smartphones? It's bound to show up in medical devices eventually. Now, what do you do about that trade-off?
Right now, I'm not seeing a whole lot of good solutions. So let me paint a somewhat dire picture, or a positive picture, depending on your perspective. With every new layer of connectivity, I view it as a new exponential increase in complexity. So right now, we have wireless devices in the hospital, in clinical environments, all communicating. And now they're beginning to get more and more connected across the internet. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not directly across the internet, sometimes through proxies, but still there are pathways across the internet. Mm-hmm. You add in things like cloud computing, just a whole other set of hard-to-quantify variables. So the complexity is increasing. I don't see anything stopping that. And so the bad news is, if you're a security or dependability person, it's a really hard sell because, of course, taking any time to think about dependability, security, safety, and such, that's engineering time that you could have spent creating a new feature.
Right. So you have your typical trade-off.
Right. So there are trade-offs. And I think it's very tricky for the seasoned engineer to be able to argue to management the value, the return on investment of security, just because it's so abstract and, you know, it's more like a process than a product, as some like to say.
Yeah, and it's an emergent property of a system and not a thing that you bolt on. So,
right.
So that makes it hard to talk about with people who may not understand what emergent phenomenon means. The challenge, I guess, is another challenge is that from a consumer perspective, there's a big trend towards people wanting to measure their own data about exercise or health or whatever and control their own data just so they can, you know, watch themselves. Like, lots of people have those run tracking things now and calorie trackers. And I think there's going to be a lot of people who want to get the data off their own device just to keep an eye on it themselves.
That's right. In fact, I just invested myself in one of those devices just for fun and trying to keep up with fitness. Mm-hmm. But those are relatively low-risk devices. Mm-hmm. They typically don't have actuators unless you count your legs as actuators.
Yeah, I'm not really thinking about those devices, but the trend that those devices indicate. You know, I want to be able to know how far I walked today. Oh, I also want to know what my pacemaker's been up to.
Right, right. So what's, I think, an interesting related case is I know of one patient who's started a public campaign to get access to his own defibrillator data. Mm-hmm. So his name's Hugo Campos, and he's been trying to get the data from his implant that the implant is recording about him.
And he can't get it.
Yes.
Who owns it?
Exactly. Well, that's the question. I think it's a gray area of who owns the data. Technically, I know he could get the data if he found someone smart enough to collect it, but then you get into issues of FCC and medical device regulation.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest problem, at least from what he's talked about in public, is the getting back to the economic factor, somewhat related to security. The economic factor for a company to invest in allowing a patient to get more access to the data.
Mm-hmm. One of the problems is, of course, that many patients will not be trained and they won't have a clue from a technical perspective what to do with the data, and they may misinterpret it. It may make them react incorrectly and so on. So
that's a possible risk, and I think it's a discussion that ought to be had and borne out. Let's put some quantification to this so that it's not just some nebulous argument.
Right.
It'd be interesting to see a control study to see if the public health outcomes are any different when there's open access or not.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a one-day kind of project.
Right. So for over a decade, I've been talking about this distinction between bugs and flaws, bugs being implementation-level defects and flaws being design-level defects. Which is more important when it comes to medical device security?
Is this a trick question?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I used to be more of the bug side. I used to think, oh, this is a bug. How dare you make this bug? And in the last few years, especially with medical devices, I think I've come through the rite of passage to believe that more of these, and you know, don't swap me yet, Gary, I know what you're going to do, that more of these are design flaws and requirements, engineering flaws, just not anticipating the requirements in the first place. Actually, I've talked to some manufacturers who said, yeah, you know, you're right. We didn't have security early on in our requirements. And some of the manufacturers do. I know of one manufacturer that now includes certain security elements at what they call the concept phase, yep, before they've completed their requirements, before they've written a line of code.
Yeah, we know of some too, because some of them are our customers, and they're asking for that sort of stuff.
Okay.
But at Cigital. So I happen to agree with your view that probably design is the trickiest bit, but I'm not sure how you teach design analysis. So you're a professor. How do you teach design analysis, even to grad students?
I think it's both an art and a science. So I can tell you what I'm doing in my course. Not only are we doing the standard academic technique of reading papers and writing essays, but we're actually going into hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually meeting with manufacturers. We're going to clinical environments to talk with nurses to learn about the real problems.
Mm-hmm.
So to get everything in context, I often hear complaints, for instance, about medical devices where it doesn't seem like it was really fielded on the correct user population. Mm. So I'm trying to expose the students to the different populations of users to see, how are they going to misuse your device?
Right. What surprising things do people do with the stuff you build?
Right. Let me give you one example, and this is where I'd say it seems like a bug, but is really, in your parlance, I think, a flaw. There was a buffer overflow in an infusion pump.
Mm-hmm.
This is a pump, an implantable pump to deliver drugs to the body, and there was a wireless control of the bolus rate. This is how much time you drip a quantum of drug.
Mm-hmm.
And the user interface didn't include a labeling of the units. That is, it didn't say whether it was hours or minutes. It just said enter the number, effectively.
Four.
Yeah. But you did have colons to separate, you know, minutes, hours, and seconds.
Right.
But so, of course, one healthcare provider made the fatal mistake of mixing up hours and minutes, and there was a 60 times overdose.
Oh.
Implanted device, so you don't feel anything. It's in the patient's abdomen.
Yeah.
The patient passed out while driving home, got in a motor vehicle accident, and then later died after the family removed life support.
Holy cow.
This is all due to a buffer overflow, which you could claim is a bug, but perhaps there was something wrong early on in the requirements, or just, really, you're using a programming language for a high-confidence medical device, and you can still commit buffer overflow errors?
Exactly. You don't check that for sanity? Come on. So last question. Do you think we're making progress in building security in, you know, kind of even outside of the medical device stuff that you've been working on lately?
Well, I'm going to answer a different question. In the medical world, I do think we're starting to make progress because I think the smart engineers recognize the coming security problem and the gravity of the situation. They're just having trouble, I think, finding a way to make their corporate entities move forward in a cost-effective way.
Mm-hmm.
In general, it's a sad quagmire. You don't have to go even one day without seeing some kind of report about the sad state of cybersecurity for everything from the power grid to SCADA systems to our financial system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not seeing a whole lot of progress. I hope that there's some reporter out there who starts to focus on the solutions rather than just the lack of them.
Well, I mean, due to the NASCAR effect, it's really hard to not want to cover the explosions and the crashes and the places where people die, because that's what humans are interested in.
Yeah, let's have a reporter talk about an airplane that landed safely. That was article.
Yes. It, dog bites man, boring. Man bites dog, interesting.
Right.
So now something completely different. As a certified bread maker, and a good one, as I can personally attest from your solstice offering many years ago, what is your favorite non-bread meal to cook, which could involve bread?
Favorite non-meal.
Non-bread meal.
I have little kids, so my menu has changed in the last few years. But before I had kids, one of my favorite ones was making ossobuco milanese, and also making a lobster bisque, which is quite tricky. If you don't know, there's very little lobster in it. Actually, you saute lobster shells.
I did not know that. I'm not a lobster bisque fanatic.
Okay, I just taught you something.
Yes, I'll have to do that. I'll have to go out and do some lobster bisque now.
Another fun one is German spätzle. It's like a noodle, but German.
Yes, that I do know. That's kind of like little tiny gnocchi.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Well, thank you for your time today.
Sure. I hope your medical devices remain secure and your bread crust-worthy.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The November-December issue of IEEE S&P Magazine focuses on lost treasures from the ancient early days of computer security. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.